listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
And now we have come to the end. It's a sad day, not only for Roger Federer fans, but myself. I am Ed McGrogan here with the final Across the Pondcast, your audio review of all things at the All England Club. Want to get in touch, of course, one more time after both the men's and women's finals. We've just, about an hour or so ago, witnessed Novak Djokovic winning Grand Slam title number 9, denying Roger Federer his 18th Grand Slam title, and successfully defending his Wimbledon title. The day before, we watched another match of historic import, even more so with Serena Williams completing her second Serena Slam, the tour around the Grand Slams in which she goes unbeaten, wins her 28th consecutive match at a major over Garbine Muguruza. Straight sets, but it is a lot more than that, as anybody who saw the match could tell you. And so both world number ones on each tour wins Wimbledon. It once again kind of ties back to what I've always said about this tournament, is it really defines most of all among above any other tournament who is really in charge on both tours. And we definitely see that with both results here on the men's and on the women's side. Serena, you know, we knew that coming in, it was her match to lose, it was her tournament to lose. It got hairy for sure, because when you go up 5-1 in the second set, double break, of course, and then are faced returning at 4-5, that can challenge anyone, including a 20-time Grand Slam champion, the undisputed world number one, you know, a veteran favorite, goes on and on and on. But the thing with Muguruza was she dug herself such a big hole going down double break. And even though she was able to get out of that hole just about all the way, she breaks Serena twice. She holds in between. All those games, super pressure packed. You know, of course, Serena arguably is facing more pressure trying to serve it out with what's on the line. But Muguruza still was unable to get back to level terms because of that service came that was on her racket, of course, at 4-5. And that's always something to consider when you're serving, quote, from behind in a set. And it came to bear there that in spite of all the ground that Serena had lost with her lead almost evaporated, she still had that one final opportunity to make amends, to kind of wipe it from memory. And truthfully, that's what's going to happen after this weekend, is no one is going to remember that she should have won this match 6-1 in the second and a blowout. And that's the way it was heading after a very good start from Muguruza in her first Grand Slam final. She showed the reason why she was there to begin with. She showed elements of how she beat Serena at the French Open the year before. And she just was unable to keep it up for a couple reasons. I mean, obviously, there is her own, I think, nerves of kind of seeing or really realizing where she's at in terms of, you know, the match she's in, the situation she is facing with a set lead, you know, not that far down the road if she can just hold serve a couple times. But of course, more of it goes to Serena, and justifiably so. She really brought herself up to another level, to break out the cliche one more time. You know, this is the last Across the Pondcast, of course, we can do that. Steve Tegner made a great observation, a great point about a particular point, which I noticed too in that match, was in that it's how he leads his review of the match is with a forehand that Serena hits that seemed to in an instant kind of change the tenor of the match. And I think, You can sense that if you're any kind of a tennis fan that's watched a lot of matches. That's the strange thing about this sport, is that for all of the points that are played, there is just so many points. After a match, it's hard to even remember singular ones because of how just the volume that we're talking about and how it just all aggregates on top, one on top of the other, to determine a winner. But you can tell sort of when they happen, a big turning point. And that's certainly what that was. It kind of signaled that Serena had kind of found her shots a little more and was kind of ready to really give Muguruza the challenge that we all expected. And in the last podcast, I said that it would be very surprising if Serena didn't win not only the match but the first set. And that's what happened. I think even getting that one set from Muguruza was going to be a challenge. And if she was going to do it, I felt like it was the second set where Serena was facing more of the pressure being in the lead. And that's really kind of how it turned out, just about, is that Serena does go on to take that first set. Muguruza can't take that big initial step and kind of really plant a seed of serious doubt in anyone's mind that this match will be anything other than Williams's. And Serena, you know, as has been the case for just about all of her Grand Slam matches of importance over the past month and a half, going back to Paris, you know, she faces a patch of resistance and just digs her way out of it, even when it looks pretty bad at times. I mean, surrendering that lead from 5-1 down to 4-5 with just a cover your eyes bad sequence of errors, you know, nothing that you would ever, if you looked at it in a vacuum and said, you know, that's a 21-time Grand Slam champion who's kind of losing, you know, 90% of the points over like a 10-minute stretch with some really unsightly errors. But that's how Serena has played over the past 5 or 6 years of her career, even when she has won buckets of titles like she's doing now. It's always been kind of this transformation at times from an unbeatable force to someone who is as vulnerable as seemingly can be. But inevitably, almost every time, it's sort of like a movie script that inevitably it always turns out well in the end for her. And it's because of, you know, not only the physical strength but the mental strength. And she manages to get it done once again, wins Wimbledon for the 6th time, wins her 21st slam, wins 4 majors in a row, and she goes into New York, into the U.S. Open, with a chance at tennis's holy grail, the calendar year, the official Grand Slam. And it almost doesn't even, to me, on the women's tour, it's almost like what does matter from now until Flushing Meadows? Because someone like a Sharapova or a Kvitova could seemingly sweep the important summer events. Serena could look, you know, dead to rights again in those events. And it wouldn't matter because you would be picking Serena to win the title in Flushing Meadows. And to Serena's credit, I expect her to come out and play those events. She always does, especially lately. It's more the latter part of her career that she has been really showing more of a willingness to play and embrace the tour-level events. And not even just Canada and Cincinnati. She always plays Stanford. I think she probably will as well. I haven't heard otherwise. But it's a matter of and I think she's going to treat those events as she treats every event nowadays, where it's like a life or death situation, is how she plays tennis. And perhaps that's why she has fared so well, is because she treats the match like it is a life or death situation. She treats it like a fan treats it, watching it. And when you see what the stakes are and what it means to her, you can kind of relate if you are one of the many hardcore sports fans. Doesn't matter what sport you follow. To me, it's like if I'm watching the Rangers in hockey, that's kind of how she treats a match at a slam. And you want your favorite athletes and your favorite players to treat these matches with that importance. And maybe that's what it boils down to with Serena, is that she simply just wants it more than anyone else. And that's clear, because the chasm between her and the rest of the tour has never been larger. It only widened after Wimbledon. It'll be a big surprise if she does not win it all in New York, and it's going to be something to watch. We'll have a little bit of a break in between, you know, from here until now. It's a good just about 2 full months, because the Open starts pretty late this year, the last weekend of August. And that's where we kind of leave the WT at the moment. I mean, for Muguruza, maybe it would be a good time to see how she kind of follows up on this during the summer stretch of her own. She's, you know, seems like really, you know, a great all-surface player. Her biggest results, of course, have come on clay and on grass now, but her on hard courts, there's no reason that game can't get it done on that surface too. And maybe that's one of the big things I'm going to look for this summer for the WTA, is how Muguruza plays after her Wimbledon run. She's going to be seated pretty highly. I have a feeling she's, I didn't check the rankings, but I would be sort of, I would be surprised if she isn't in the top 10. So, you know, a lot more attention, of course, better ranking, better seedings at these tournaments. So I think seeing how she follows up on this could be worth our time too. So that's where we leave Serena and Muguruza. Both of them, obviously, great Wimbledons. They both it's a very happy ceremony all around, truthfully. I think, you know, it was a day that neither of those two will forget, and I think that both, of course, look back on it pretty fondly. Oddest ending to a Grand Slam final, by the way, of all time. A shot of Muguruza's that was clearly out. It wasn't even a disputed call. It wasn't challenged or anything, but there was just a delay in sort of acknowledging game, set, match Serena. And I don't know if that gets put on the chair umpire or on someone else, but just a strange sort of anticlimactic ending to the match. Unfortunately, we've seen that a couple times at Wimbledon recently. You also had, when Federer won in 2012, you know, he had the Hawkeye call, always the thing I've sort of dreaded the most when it comes to that, is having a match wait on a decision of the replay. So, I mean, that's a good segue, in fact, into the men's Wimbledon final. Roger, you know, unlike 2012, does not get to celebrate at the end. You know, for the second straight year, he goes down to Djokovic. This one in four sets, 7-6-1, 7-6-10, 6-4-6-3. And it's a tough one for Roger, for sure, because of the, you know, the way he played against Murray in the semis, which was lauded and rightfully so by anybody who watched that. It was just a pinnacle performance for him. Did not have that consistency and ability in this match, certainly in the last two sets, but really throughout. You know, the first two sets were definitely a tough grind for Federer, even though he gets out of them with a split. You know, the first set, Federer has two set points. Now, they're both on when returning, and, you know, when you look back at this match, you kind of forget that because of how well Djokovic played overall, but you can think back to those two set points that Djokovic saves with big serves and really kind of say that's the key to this whole match, because for as well as Djokovic is, well, as well as he returned amazingly, some of the best returns we've seen, especially in a fast court like this, as well as he was off the ground, this was a great baseline performance from Djokovic, where we, you know, we saw all the angles, all the depth, all the power, the placement, the retrieving. It was, you know, really just great stuff from him along the ground. But he served impeccably at Wimbledon on center court, and that made his service schemes, you know, so challenging for Federer that in the last two sets of the match, he almost gave no openings to Federer. There was tremendous pressure on Federer to hold, not only because Djokovic was doing it so routinely on his serve. For as much as we see nerves play a part in even the greatest players closing matches out, like Serena, for example, and Djokovic, last year at Wimbledon and many other times, it doesn't matter who it is or where it is, they always kind of rear their head. Djokovic had no trouble putting this away in the end. And, he breaks Federer to do it with a forehand winner to end it all. But it didn't seem like even if Federer pushed Djokovic to hold serve at 5-4 that it was going to make too much of a difference, because Djokovic was hitting the wide serve beautifully. He was serving aces. He was out acing Federer for portions of this match. And just, you know, targeting the backhand, all the things that you would expect that you'd have to do to beat Federer at Wimbledon, Djokovic did those perfectly on Sunday. It was a performance that also kind of, one thing it really caught my attention was it made me think back to how well Stan Wawrinka played at Roland Garros to beat Djokovic. And some people on Twitter, when I put that out there, said, you know, it kind of goes both ways, that Djokovic wasn't bringing this aggressive mentality. He wasn't kind of applying that pressure. But I say, you know, in part that's because of the pressure that Stan was able to summon and put on Djokovic in Paris. And, you know, Federer certainly wasn't consistent enough to do that. I thought he was hitting the ball well on all sides. It's just, so many balls in the net. And, you know, he had to play that way given the sort of the level that Djokovic was at. I mean, he said so himself after this match in the encore interview that, you know, this was a great showing from Djokovic, and it was going to be hard for anybody to beat him, period. And Roger made no bones about that. I think he realized simply that Djokovic was just too good on this day. It was an enduring struggle to get the one set. That was in the second set, where Federer saved 7 set points total, 6 of them in a tiebreaker that he ends up winning 12-10. So if you want to take something away from this Wimbledon for Federer fans, it's, you know, think back to obviously the match against Murray. Murray ends up holding that epic game. Federer then holds it love and takes the match from there. You know, this match, that tiebreaker is a great one. The battle of 12-10, I'll call it, because, Djokovic goes up 6-3. Federer saves 3 set points, and you probably at that stage saw the best overall tennis of the whole match. You know, right there, Djokovic really just kind of furious with himself for letting those chances slip by. You can't blame him for that, because you really, even with Federer winning that tiebreaker, you knew it was going to be still an uphill struggle, but it was startling at how quickly the terms of the match sort of reverted right back to Djokovic, and he does so with a break right away in the third. There's a minor rain delay. The roof doesn't get closed, which I was happy to see. You don't really like to see the roof closed at all on center court at Wimbledon. It just doesn't seem right, especially for a final. And Djokovic really just from that point on kind of holds Federer at bay and does exactly what he needs to do to win the match. And that's kind of what it comes down to. And, you know, Djokovic now with 9 slams, he he moves up the list. He passes, I know, some all-time greats along the way in doing so. Pretty close to number 10. He could do that in New York. I mean, I'm sure he'd love to get it, even if it takes him to get to Paris to do it, because that could finally get that off his back. But, you know, we're seeing, simply put, yet another, a third all-time great player within the past few years. Within the past decade, we're seeing three of the greatest men's tennis players of all time. And it's just, it's a treat to watch if you're any kind of fan of the sport, especially if you appreciate, you know, the history of the sport and have seen when tennis hasn't been at its high on one tour or the other. I'm looking forward to seeing whoever wants to pen the first great, you know, masterwork about this golden era of the game, because it's going to be hard to put into words. There's so many good matches. You know, I was on Twitter, I was rattling down the, you know, just the Wimbledon men's finals since 07, and you think back to those, you have Federer over Nadal in five, you know, Rafa turns the table in probably the greatest match ever in 2008. You know, next year, Federer comes back, beats Roddick 16-14 in a fifth. You have 3 years of these, of Djokovic, Federer, and Nadal winning a title, all in their own significant way. Not like classic matches, but big, you know, big results. Yeah. Then you get to 2013. You have Murray ending the drought, 77 years at Wimbledon for a British men's player. Last year, you had this Djokovic-Federer five-setter that was a great one. This year, you have another nice match between the two. I thought, you know, after the second set, I thought depending on where the match went from that point, it could have been talked about in those very reverent terms of really some of the best matches we've seen. It didn't turn out that way. It did, you know, kind of, that was certainly the climax, was the second set. But you just get another great showing from this elite, uber elite tier of players. And for Djokovic, I am curious to see how far he ends up taking this, because he just turned 28. Djokovic, just in spite of all this, he is a tough guy to figure out, because he still is just now 9-8 in Grand Slam finals. It's not like a Federer or Nadal record in finals where if he gets there, you can pretty much, you know, there's a good bet at least that he wins it. You know, Federer goes now down to, I believe, 17-9 in Slam finals. So it's, you know, it's certainly not as if Federer is losing any luster or history. I mean, just to make it this far at 33, soon to be 34 by the U.S. Open is, you know, just something in and of itself. But for Djokovic, you know, he's at a time clearly where he is the top dog on tour. Just like Serena, he's got to be the favorite at the U.S. Open to win three slams this year. And, you know, he's definitely capable of challenging his 2011 season, which I don't think anybody thought he was going to do after that. 2011, he finished 67-4 with three slams. And he is, you know, on pace to do better than that, I believe, if, you know, with the extreme caveat being that he would have to win the Open. But, you know, if he was to do that and get to the end of the year with 10 slams, boy, just, you know, what more can you say about these players? And they're still doing it. And this was, you know, in spite of last year where we saw two sort of surprise winners of the slams in Wawrinka and Cilic. Stan, of course, with some staying power, takes the French Open this year. It's a great time to follow the game on both tours, that's for sure. It's a great time for tennis fans. There is, I don't think there's any dispute in that, no matter who you follow, no matter what you thought of the Wimbledon finals. It's a good time, and that's my belated applause of the day. Will go to tennis. Tennis gets the applause of the day, the final one on the Across the Podcast. We're definitely going to do this again at the Open, the U.S. Open for sure. I'll be there, you know, pretty much every one of the days, because it's local for us here at Tennis Magazine and Tennis.com. You know, I've enjoyed these because it gives me some flexibility, some freedom. You know, I got the edit responsibilities. It's tough to sit down and craft, you know, that wonder piece like Steve can do. Not that I can do him any justice, but it's easier, and it gives some quick reaction to do it on a podcast and put it through a different medium, through iTunes, through SoundCloud that we're doing here. So I've been happy with this choice of communication here over the fortnight. So definitely thank all you for tuning in and for your kind words on the Across the Podcast. It will have to be named something differently, of course. You know, Welcome to the Concrete Jungle or something. We'll have GNR playing the intro. We probably can't afford that, but you can only hope. Maybe I'll talk to get Axl Rose to sponsor or something. So until then, and until our further podcast where Steve and I will reconvene over the summer at a certain point, we hope you enjoyed Wimbledon and all the Wimbledon coverage on tennis.com, and hope you keep coming back for more. This is Ed McGrogan for the Across the Podcast, signing off.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.